Hey everyone, this is Pete Perusik, and I want to welcome you to this edition of the Weathered Athlete Podcast, a place for us to honor those athletes that refuse to go quietly into the night. As a weathering triathlete and a physical therapist, I will spend my time talking with those athletes that continue to make the necessary repairs and continue to move forward. They may have a few cracks in their foundation or a squeaky step, and their patinas may continue to fade, but they are no less glorious than years prior. In fact, I feel they have more heart and resolve as they have weathered, and can provide the pathway and set the standard that we should all live by. My goal is to determine what sets these individuals apart from the rest of society. Don't forget to hit subscribe, leave a comment, and share with your friends. Today I'm honored to be joined by Joe Randini for mile number 27. I had the pleasure of meeting Joe 2 years ago when he attended a charity event I was doing for Crohn's and colitis. I had seen Joe around and knew him casually as an ultra runner due to my trips into Fleet Feet Greensboro. He did that day what I expected any ultra runner to do, to come out and run over 50 miles, which is what he did. What I did not realize until I checked out his website and blog during the year of COVID, that he has such an interesting backstory and he is such an incredible human, which is why he is a perfect representation and fit for the Humans of Hoka commercial he debuted in this year. Some may find his path to running and ultras very similar, including the use of Google to search out how do people run, and coming across and using the Couch to 5K program. I often wonder how many of those people that come across that or any other 5K planning program find hesitation and resistance as they begin down that rabbit hole of fitness and lifestyle modifications. Joe is a great example of the amazing journey that self-discovery, learning what is important, and then being true to that purpose. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Joe as much as I did.
So, hey, Joe, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm good. It's good to see you again, Pete.
Yeah, it's good seeing you too. It's always nice running with you a little bit. I'm glad we got to run some at the solstice.
Yeah, we do it about once a year, huh?
Yeah, I appreciate you coming out. So I appreciate you taking a few minutes just to kind of talk about things. You have such a great story. So I'm going to kind of let you kind of just delve into everything a little bit. But were you always an athlete?
So first of all, thanks for having me. I mean, I appreciate the opportunity to share a platform. So, but yeah, I mean, as a child, we definitely played sports. You know, I played football, I played hockey. So as a young child, I played sports, but I was obese as a child. And I think, you know, for me, for lack of a better word, relationship with food or how I experienced food was, as a child, you kind of, whatever your parents, you know, kind of provide. My father left when I was about 3 years old. So it was just me, my mom, and my sister. And, you know, I think that my mother's eating habits, you know, this is in the 70s when, before there was probably a lot of, real good guidance on nutrition. You know, we didn't have the best example, the best eating habits, a lot of fried food and probably too much food and not enough exercise, things like that. So even though I was athletic, so I did play these sports, I think, it wasn't enough to kind of overcome, my diet. And, you know, I'm talking, this is from probably the age of, you know, when I was born until I was probably about 13 or 14 years old. And you're kind of more under the influence of what's going around, you know, on around you versus making decisions yourself.
Yeah. Where'd you grow up?
First about, 7-8 years, maybe even a little bit longer than that, was Bronx, New York. Okay. And then we slowly kind of migrated north, you know, as the city got a little bit worse, a little more violent, my entire family started to migrate a little bit further north into New York. So ultimately we ended up in a place called Peekskill, New York. Okay. And I went to a school in a little town called Shrub Oak, New York.
Okay. So where'd you go to college?
I went to Franklin University. So I was in the military, and I actually was one of the first people probably to start with online school. So the military offered us opportunity to get educated while we were still in the military. So I started that process and then continued on when I got out of the military, continued my secondary education while I was working. So You know, I got married young, had kids young, and you know, getting my education was important to me. It was important to my family. Mm-hmm. But it took probably over the course of probably 10 or 12 years for me to complete a bachelor's degree while I was working full time and being a husband and a father, you know, to my children. So, but got that done you know, was able to create a life as an executive. So, I mean, it definitely paid off. Education normally does, right?
Yeah.
So it was worth all the effort to get my bachelor's degree while I was, you know, still working full time.
Okay. What'd you get your bachelor's in?
Business administration.
Okay. And then what branch of the military were you in?
So I was in the U.S. Navy for 6 years. So I joined right out of high school because, you know, as I said earlier, you know, kind of didn't have a male role model around or a father, and really didn't see going to college as like a real opportunity for me. So I kind of knew I had to do something to get an education that I could use to eventually get a good job. So I went to the recruiter, and I've had family members that were in the Navy. I took what they call the ASVAB test, and they came back and said, "Hey, you know, you can qualify for the nuclear power program. So if you want to become a nuclear engineer, we'll pay for a couple of years of school, and then you know, you give us 4 years of service." So I did the 6 years. I did 2 years of schooling, and then the 4 years of service. I was on a fast attack submarine. And you know, Virginia Beach is where I ended up meeting my wife.
Okay. Oh, that's awesome. And then how many kids do you have?
Oh, we've got 5 kids.
Okay. So what age?
They're all grown up now. 20, they range anywhere from 21 all the way up to, 31 now.
Wow. So, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm pretty busy, I'm sure, early on.
We were always busy, you know, five kids will keep your hands full. But I think, you know, we always loved having the big family, and it was great to, you know, it brings us a lot of joy to see these guys grow up and start making their own impression on the world, you know.
That's awesome. So you a grandfather?
I am not. Surprisingly, I am not. We're waiting. We've got a couple of prospects, but no grandchildren yet, so...
Well, that'll be cool when it does happen, I'm sure.
yeah, absolutely.
So I saw corporate life. What did you do?
So when I finally retired early, I was operations director at Sherwin-Williams. You know, I kind of started my career in manufacturing, so as a supervisor, and then just worked my way up over the years, you know, supervisor to warehouse manager to production manager to operations director. And then I would always put my hat in for any interesting opportunities. So one of the things Sherwin-Williams had was an acquisition team. We were always looking to grow, and we were always looking for really good companies to kind of merge with. So I said, "Hey, I would love to participate in that. You know, I'd love to be a member of this team and help us look at the different companies and how do they fit strategically and financially and all these different things." And one of the areas we were growing in was Europe. So I'm Italian. You know, my background's Italian. My wife had an interest in living in Italy. So I saw that we were going to probably acquire some of these companies in Europe, and some of them were in Italy. Mm-hmm. So I started to teach myself to speak Italian. And when we acquired the companies and went over, I was the only executive who could hold a conversation in Italian with them. So sure enough, boss called, you know, a couple days after we had our first initial meetings over there and said, you know, "You and your wife want to move the family over to Italy for 3 years." And we said, "Absolutely," you know, so we jumped on that, and it ended up being like 6.5 years.
Wow, that's awesome. So when was that?
We moved from Greensboro in 2010, and we came back in 2016.
Okay. Yeah. So the whole time was in Italy. Where were you?
Yeah, so my family lived in Florence, Italy. That's where we kind of had an apartment. But I ended up having a place, an apartment in Poznan, Poland. I was in Manchester, England a lot. So So I was kind of traveling all over Europe because we had, you know, plants all throughout the, the both continental Europe and England. And I ended up spending a ton of time in all these various places. So I'd be traveling pretty frequently, and they would be home in Florence. I'd be home on the weekend, or sometimes I'd fly them out to where I was so that they could see, you know, a different place.
That is so cool. So how was it living in Europe?
It was great. It was an interesting, you know, experience, because I don't think, you can truly broaden your horizons if you're not willing to kind of branch out. Right. So for us, this was huge. It wasn't just moving from one state to another. This is moving from one country to another. Yeah. And over there, if you kind of look at it like, you know, the United States, every state was a different country with a different culture, right? So you could drive from Italy to, you know, you could drive to, you know, to France from Italy, right? Or you can, you know, easily hop on a flight and be in Spain or, you know, whatever. So, you know, it was great because we got to not just experience, you know, Italy, we got to experience all these different places, and you just start to realize, you know, how diverse the world really is, and that there's a lot of different ways of viewing the same topics, and there's a lot of different ways of living life, and none of them are better than the other, and none of them are wrong or right. It's just, you know, cultural, right? So for us and for our children, I think it was an extremely beneficial investment, the 6.5 years we did over there, even though we missed our family and missed some things over here. Because they all, you know, got cultured and balanced and saw that there's different views, which I think, and especially in this day and age, if more people could respect a different point of view, maybe we'd be a little bit better off.
I agree. What a great, you know, for your kids, what a great experience.
Yeah, it was. It was great. It was great for all of us.
So did they learn Italian?
The kids learned to speak Italian. One of the kids actually learned to speak a couple of languages. So they came back, you know, with bilingual at least, but some of them with even more than that. And you almost, because you hear so many different languages, and they were exposed to so many different kids because they were in an international school. So they went to school with Russian kids and Persian kids and Italian kids and Spanish kids, and you start to pick up all sorts of, you know, little parts of every language that you're exposed to, including myself. Like, you know, I could speak a little bit of Polish, I can speak a little bit of French, I can speak Italian, I can speak a little Spanish, you know, and it's just because it's all around you, you know. I tell people all the time when they ask about going there for vacation, I always suggest to spend more time in a place rather than try to slam as much in as possible, because you might get the breath if you go over there and you know, go from train stop to train stop, but you won't get the depth. And to me, sitting out for a 2 or 3 hour meal on a street in Florence and just listening to the music of the people walk by and all the different languages, you know, that's more value in that than seeing another painting or seeing another statue. Like, there's just this incredibly diverse and deep exposure to people over there because it's so close. Everybody's so close together, that you don't get as much here, especially in a rural place. You know, places that are a little more urban over here, you probably have a little more of that. But over there, especially where it's a touristy place, you know, you can hear 5, 6, 7 different languages in an hour. You know, it's incredible.
Yeah, that's amazing. So how was your health during all that travel and everything? What was that like?
Yeah, so that's kind of, you know, when we talk about 50-year-old athlete and stuff like that, right, is, you know, my story, you know, about 13 or 14, I got healthy. And I did that because, like most young men, you know, you start to realize there's girls, right? So you start looking around, we're going into high school, and you don't want to be that fat kid, right? So playing sports and eating right, and, you know, and I got healthy. And then when I joined the military, it's another healthy lifestyle, right? You're doing a little bit more exercise, you're invested in your health. So, you know, that kind of brings you to, you know, I was 24, 25 when I got out of the Navy and started my corporate career, you know. And for me, it wasn't like even over in Europe, it wasn't like I gained all the weight in Europe. It was literally that 3 to 5 pounds a year type of a thing. It was like a drip, 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 right? And, you know, that kind of drip, drip, drip has quite the impact when you apply it over 20 years. Mm-hmm. So to me, what happened was, you know, 3 to 5 pounds a year over the course of, you know, 20 years or so, I woke up one morning. It was, you know, you said you read some of the blog. It was, I think, May of 2014. And I was 330 plus pounds, you know. And I had to travel that day. I was going to Paris. I was going to France. And I always would catch the early flight in the morning so I could be home for the weekend. And I was literally up about 3:30 in the morning, kind of rummaging around the room looking for running sneakers, you know. And my wife heard the noise and kind of woke up and said, like, what are you looking for? I said, I'm looking for, you know, a pair of running sneakers. And she kind of like, what are you talking about? And I said, you know, I have a pair of running shoes. And she said, well, check the bottom of the curio thing over there and, you know, see if you, you know. So I found these shoes and I threw them in the bag. And, you know, and I said, I'm going to run tonight. When I get done with work and I get back to the hotel, I'm going to go for a run. And, you know, I got done working that night, you know, best intentions. I got back to the hotel, put on my shoes. I bet you if I made it 50 feet, I'd be surprised. And I was huffing and puffing and, you know, all sorts of stuff was coming out of my nose. And I just thought in my head, like, how do people do this? You know, I mean, I'm this big, fat, middle-aged guy, and I'm trying to do the right thing here, but I couldn't go 50 feet.
Yeah.
So I put my head down and walked back to the, you know, to the hotel room, and I did what most people do nowadays. I got on Google, and I Googled, like, how do people start running, and how do overweight people run, and, you know, these types of things. And, of course, a bunch of couch to 5K mm-hmm. type stuff popped up. So I started reading that, and as smart as I'd like to think I am, I was like, man, this makes a lot of sense, this walk-run interval thing, and try to close the intervals, and, you know. Mm-hmm. So day two, you know, the next night when I got back, I said, all right, I'm going to go out and I'm going to try this couch to 5K. I'm going to, you know, take the program here and approach it that way. And so that's what I did. I started to, you know, be consistent, get out there, you know, per that program. If it said to walk 2 minutes and run for 30 seconds, that's what I did. And slowly but surely, I felt better and I felt stronger. And you kind of start thinking, like, you know, what do I do to put more things in my favor here, right? So naturally, you start saying, all right, I'm going to cut out some of the alcohol and I'm going to start drinking water. And so I started doing those things. And over the course of 4, 5, 6 weeks, you know, I noticed, like, the runs got a little bit easier. I was able to run a little bit longer. Weight started to come off a little bit. I felt a lot better. And as a byproduct of that, one of the things I write about, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but mm-hmm. when you kind of go through something like this, right, whether it's weight loss or something else, when you have this epiphany, like, I'm going to make a change, you almost have to be willing to kill the old you mm-hmm. to become the new you, you know. And in the process of doing that, you lose some acquaintances and you make some new acquaintances, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I used to be that guy who we'd get home after work and, you know, hey guys, you know, we're all out of town. We're all on, you know, the company dime. We're all going out to dinner tonight. So let's go out to dinner and let's go grab some beers. And, you know, you'd be out till 1, 2 in the morning and then you get back to the hotel and you don't get any good sleep and you got to be back at work. And, you know, so I was kind of that guy, like, hey, I loved it. Let's go have some fun, you know? And when, you know, I started making these small changes, you realize, like, you can't be that guy anymore, mm-hmm. you know? So I realized very quickly, like, you know, I was going to have to give some things up. And it did have an impact on some relationships with people. We don't dislike each other. But the point is, if someone's going to go out and eat a big dinner and then drink till 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night, you know, and you've got to get up and run the next morning, you're probably not going to go with them, you know. So, so it's an interesting thing, you know. And then what happens is, you know, I found a buddy who had a similar interest, right? So a person noticed, like, I'm not going out and I'm getting up and running. And he kind of approached me. We had known each other, a guy named Dave Pettit. He's an English guy. And we had known each other and we were friendly, but he kind of came to me and said, "Oh, I see you started trying to run." And I said, "Yeah, I've been doing it, you know, 6-7 weeks or whatever." And he's like, "Let's go tomorrow morning together. Let's go for a run, you know?" And I was like, "Dave, I can't run like you." I said, "I'm, you know," and he's like, "I'll go at your pace, you know." But I think Dave realized, like, you know, there's this guy who's going through this process and he probably needs some support and a new friend, and that kind of thing. And then sure enough, you know, Dave and I are like brothers now, mm-hmm. you know, and to this day, you know, I literally went and translated in Italy for his wedding because they got married in Italy, him and his wife. And, but the point is, like, my new friends are Pete's, right?
Yeah.
My new friends are people who are into the same thing, right? So my friends are ultra runners. My friends are triathletes, right? But a lot of my old friends, even though we might still be in touch, we're not close anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the process. A lot of people, and one of the reasons I wrote about it is because I think it's an interesting part of the process that a lot of people don't understand. Like, you want to surround yourself with the people who are going to love and support you. Mm-hmm. And when you go through these types of changes, that's what's going to happen naturally. You're going to start to make decisions that are more aligned with what you're trying to do. So better eating and, you know, and not drinking alcohol and those types of things. And that means you're going to kill your old self a little bit and leave some of your old friends behind. And you're going to find this whole new set of friends in this whole new world. And I think that's important because I think that a lot of people, they don't realize that that's going to happen. And that's part of the stumbling blocks, like one of the obstacles you got to get over to move forward. But and I think it applies to if you wanted to learn to play the guitar, mm-hmm. you know, suddenly, you know, you're going to have new guitar friends, right? And, yeah. and you're going to probably lose some friends who don't want to sit around and listen to you play the guitar, right? So, so I think it's just, it was an interesting part of the journey and a necessary part of the journey. And I love all my old friends, but I can tell you that I love all my new friends. And my life's been enhanced because the goals that I've set for myself, my life's aligned with those goals now. Mm-hmm. And the people I'm surrounded with, you know, all the way up to my career change, right, are now, you know, exactly on the same kind of plane that I'm on, right? So that helps a lot. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think it's so true. But I think that's why some people don't want to make that change because I think they're afraid of giving up or giving up on that past. And I think they struggle. And I think, again, people who actually, that's why I love this podcast, because most people have come to this later on in life, over 50, and, you know, they've had some baggage and stuff, and something has triggered them and they've made a change. And I think it's important that you almost have, you're right, you have to let that old self die to kind of move forward. And the hope is that by you setting that example, those people that maybe you say, "I can't believe Joe's doing this. Who does he think he is?" Maybe that motivates them to say, you know, if he can do it, maybe I can do it. Look at where he was. Maybe I can try that. But I know there's a lot of people that won't do it just because they're just, I think they become complacent. I think that's the other thing. You just, "Oh, this is how it's going to be. And it's not going to work. I'm just going to keep going the way I'm going." So, you know, there's a lot of fear, I think, sometimes.
Any new endeavor, mm-hmm. fear is the first obstacle that you have to get over, right? All the things you want are right on the other side of fear,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So it's all about, you know, understanding that it's going to be scary and being okay with that. Like, you have to get uncomfortable to grow.
Yeah.
You don't grow if you're not willing to challenge yourself and become uncomfortable. So I think you nailed it right on the head. As you start to try to make changes, you know, you get scared and there's this fear. Mm-hmm. And for the people who can successfully continue to grow, they learn to manage that fear and deal with it, right?
Yeah.
So it's like I said, to me, those are the fascinating things about these types of changes. When you talk about someone who at our age makes a decision to make a change, you know, overcoming that complacency and realizing you're going to go through that fear and get past it, you know, those are the things you have to get right up here, mm-hmm. you know, before you can get right physically.
Yeah. So how old were you when that started, that transition?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was 44 when I kind of had that lightning bolt moment. And then, you know, I think my first, so when we get kind of into the like ultra running and things mm-hmm. like that, my first 100 mile race, I was 48.
Okay.
And then I've run 200 mile races since I've turned 50.
Okay.
And I don't like, it's interesting when you talk to me about this, like, hey, it was like whether athletes were looking for people that are kind of over 50 and have done these transitions later in life, that kind of thing. And the, you know, the thing I thought about in my head instantly was like, I feel like I'm getting better. Like, I feel mm-hmm. like I'm getting stronger. Right. Yeah. So to me, the number never occurred to me like, oh, you're this over 50 athlete. It just occurred to me that as I started to make more of the right decisions, mm-hmm. that my body got stronger and my mind got stronger and I'm able to do more things now at 50 than I probably could do when I was 35 or 40.
Yeah.
So it never, like the age thing never like occurred to me. Like that component never crossed my mind. I just go out and do the things I need to do, and I don't even think about my age.
And you should. And that's the thing is, you know, if you look around with any of these events, age is just a number. I've seen there's some 70-year-olds that can put it down, and you know, you're thinking like, how can they do that? So, you know, it doesn't matter. And so it's pretty cool to see. And that's why, again, as a physical therapist, I love seeing my patients in their 80s and 90s and even up to the 100. And I'm involved with the senior games here locally. And I love the senior game track events. It is my favorite thing to watch these 80 and 90-year-olds run around the track. And it's just, their energy is better than some 40 and 50 year olds I've seen. So it's pretty cool. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I love it too. When I'm out there at a ultra marathon and you see that 70-year-old person, you know, come in under 30 hours and get their buckle, man, you're just like, I want to be that person, right? I want to grow up to be them.
Yeah, that is such a cool thing. So when you like that first 10K, how difficult was it?
That's a great question, right? The first 10K. So you know, my friend Dave basically he goes, look, I've seen a lot of people go through what you're going through. I suggest you put a race on the calendar, like hold yourself accountable. And you know, this was probably June or July of 2014. And he had asked me to do this thing the year before called the Manchester 10K, the Great Manchester 10K in Manchester, England. And of course I wasn't running and I was, you know, so I was like, okay, Dave, and I never did it. But I told him, I said, yeah, I'll sign up for 2015. So I signed up and I put that out on the calendar and I had something to work towards when, I'm not someone who does a lot of research normally. So, I showed up thinking 10K, this is just going to be a small couple hundred people, maybe kind of run, you know? So I landed in Manchester, I get to my hotel and there's people everywhere. And I asked the lady when I'm checking in, like, what's going on down here this weekend? And she goes, the race. And I said, what race? And she goes, the Great Manchester 10K. And I said, I'm in that race. And she goes, yeah, you didn't know it's the largest 10K in the world. And I said, no, I had no idea. How big are we talking here? And she goes, oh, there'll be 60,000 people running tomorrow. So I call up my buddy and I'm like, Dave, you know, this is my first 10K. And the lady just told me it's going to be on TV and there's 60,000 people running this thing. And he's like, yeah, is that a problem? And I was like, you know, I know it's for a good cause, but, you know, I was thinking a little more, you know, something a little more quaint maybe for my first 10K. No. So we went out there and I guess the reason for the backstory there is, how do you not run when you have literally hundreds of thousands of people on both sides of the whole race? Every kilometer they had a band.
Yeah.
Like, It was probably the best environment I could have been in for my first 10K because there was so much juice, like external juice. My adrenaline, I was amped up. So I think I ran that 10K for my first 10K in under an hour, which, you know, was a great goal for me, you know. So, but I loved it. I was hooked. Like when I got done running that thing, I was hooked. I could not believe how many people showed up for that event. And you know, and the positivity, like everybody roots for you, you know, that's the other thing I think about our running community. Whether it's someone starting out or whether it's the ultra running community, I don't think I've ever heard a runner put down another runner. They've always pulled you up. Even when I was starting and I was a big heavy guy, I'd run by these guys on the road that were in great shape. And they would tell you good job or, you know, you know, and I think that's what really, really hooked me into it was just that positivity. There's just, you know, so much positivity, love and support in the running community. And I love it. I wish that somehow the world could expand that feeling, you know, because to me, the beauty of running is, you know, the people around you, they've all got their reasons why they're out there. And they're all supporting each other. It's just a really awesome part of the sport.
Yeah. You just stole what I was going to say. Cause I agree. I think if we could somehow harness that and use that in everyday life, I think we'd be in a much, much better place. My, first marathon was actually Marine Corps and I chose that for a reason because of just the environment and just, you know, as I'm struggling, I look over and there's a guy without any legs on a wheelchair, on a skateboard, just bare knuckling the whole thing. And it's like, okay, I don't care what I'm feeling right now. That's incredible. And then the people picking you up the whole way, cheering you on, like they have no idea who you are. And they're out there. Maybe they know somebody. Maybe they're just there to cheer. It's just, I love the sport. I love that. I love triathlon. I just love anything that gets out there and you just basically, we're all there for, you know, when we're going to compete, you know, and I'm sure you're a competitor too. We'll get to that. But at the end of the day, it's about helping that other person across the finish line. So that's the best part of this sport.
So I don't know if you want to delve into a side story here, but I was just in Virginia Beach, right?
Okay.
My brother-in-law, 8 years ago to the day, so today is the anniversary, was in a motorcycle accident. And he had something called an internal decapitation. So his head, I guess the C1 and C2 part of the vertebrae, was basically ripped off internally. And only like a strand of a nerve or something basically held it together. Wow. So we were in Italy at the time, and we got a phone call, and they basically told us, Chris will not make it through the night. He's going to die. And you know, as the night progressed, he did not die. And they kind of said, well, if he makes it, he'll never walk again. Well, Chris, you know, he made it and they literally had to screw his head back on. So he has a bar that runs from his spine into his skull and it's all screwed together. Over the course of the last 8 years, he's just kind of slowly been on this journey. He went through the depression. He went through, you know, figuring out like, what's he going to do with his life next? And he's really into like barbecue now and things like that. He does what he can, but he realized like, even though the doctors were telling him physical activity might not be the best thing for him, if he was going to continue to do the things he wanted to do in a fulfilled way, that he was going to have to get stronger. So he started exercising. So, I went to, you know, to visit everybody this weekend, 4th of July weekend. And, he goes, hey man, are you running tomorrow? And I said, I am. And he goes, I want to go out and try to run 5 kilometers tomorrow. He goes, I've been walking on the treadmill. I've been running. He goes, I know, you know, I've done a little bit of running on the road. He goes, but I want to try 5 kilometers tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So I said, Chris, anything you want, I'll be there for you.
Yeah.
I've run literally 10,000 miles or more in the last 7 years. Mm-hmm. We went out and ran 5Ks, 3.1 miles. He did it in like 37 minutes and 20 something seconds, which is great.
Wow.
He's 50 and he's got this, you know, injury. That was probably the best or most joyful 3.1 miles I've ever run in my entire life.
Yeah.
The next day he goes, are you running again? I said, yeah, I'm running again. He goes, I want to go back out. And he goes, I just might do a mile or two, but I just want to go back out. So I was like, hey, great. So we go back out. And I could tell, you know, about a mile and a half in, he was trying to beat yesterday, right? Garmin should give him a contract. He was trying to beat yesterday. And I said, Chris, you have it. Do you want me to push you? And he said, yeah. He finished that second 5K in 35 minutes and like 51 seconds or something like that. But
awesome.
The incredible thing to me is, like you said, everybody who's out there is going through something. Nobody that we ran past that day knew what he was going through. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, this guy is like literally probably in more pain than I am at the end of a 100-miler just trying to do these 3 miles. It was a huge accomplishment for him.
Yeah.
And it was just such an incredible story. Like this guy that they told us wouldn't make it through the night, and he's out there running again. I mean, that's the kind of stuff in this sport that, you know, you just can't get anywhere else. You know, the veterans that are out there on a skateboard, or gentlemen like him who's, you know, told he wasn't going to walk again. There's, you know, the beauty of especially ultra running, when you get out there in the middle of the night and you're 20 hours in,
yeah,
you come across people, there's stories of drug addiction, depression, abuse, like they're all out there for a reason. And yeah, running has become their therapy and saved their lives in a lot of cases, you know, and I just find it fascinating that the sport can bring so many people together that way. And the stories you hear when you're out there, and, you know, you were talking about being competitive and yet still supporting each other. I've multiple times made the decision to stay with someone, yeah, and help them rather than go for a better time or whatever, because there was more joy and value in helping someone accomplish something, yeah, than there was in going and beating my personal record or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a huge part of the sport. You know, like, I think people really prefer to see other people succeed.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I think there's a great feeling about that. You know, you're right. A medal, and you have yours in the back. I have mine in the back. But again, it's the stories of those races and who I was with during those races are more important to me. And those are the things I value. Like, I couldn't tell you the time of a lot of my races because I don't pay. It's great. Maybe I pay attention at that moment. But again, it's who was I with and what kind of fun did we fun as we can, you and I can call it fun. Other people may not. It's just the experience of that event. Have you ever done Ainsley's Angels at all?
Do you know I have not. I've worked with the organization. We've helped them, Fleet Feet, you know, working at Fleet, yeah, Feet. We've supported a lot of what they do, but I've never done it myself. And I think that's one of the things I would love to do, like a goal of mine, you know?
I cannot tell you enough. You have to do it. I did it once. We went to Winston, did Moonlight Madness. It was one of those last minute things. You're like, hey, we need some people to push the basically the kids. And so I went there not really knowing what I was getting myself into. And I went in with a friend of mine, Eric Revel, and we pushed this little girl. And, you know, Winston's up and down, and we kind of took turns. We pushed a little bit. He pushed. I pushed. And the whole time, it was her first time in basically the stroller, the, what do you want to call them, running.
Yeah.
Drawing a blank what to call them. But she was just biggest smile on her face. And all you could do, like I was suffering, pushing her up this hill. And you just wanted to go faster. You wanted to go faster, yeah, and get her across the finish line. And she loved it the whole time. And she was just giddy. And it was like, that's the... Of all the races I've done between marathons, triathlons, that is still the best feeling I've ever had in anything I've ever done.
Yeah. It's just, how could you not, right?
You can. So I still see that little girl smile, you know, as we pushed her across the finish line and she wanted to go faster, still wasn't fast enough.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I love about this sport. And that's a goal, you know, and that's something I know I can get done quickly. Like I can just go talk. They're always looking for help.
Yeah.
It's a great organization and yeah, it's, and that's what's crazy about it is you're going to get more out of it than the children are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that first 100 miler, what was that?
The first one I ever ran was in October of 2018. It's a local race called Alice in Woods Halloween Hobble.
Okay.
And it's out in Statesville. A guy named Drew Combs, the Allison Farm, basically, like Doggett Farm,
yeah.
You know. They create a 4-mile course, so it's very well supported, and that's why we chose it. It was close to the house, and it was extremely well supported. So, I didn't have to worry about, you know, running in a vest or anything like that. You know, you could just go out and try to get the task done. And for your first 100-miler, in my opinion, you know, that's kind of what you want to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just want to get one under your belt, because running 100 miles, running a marathon, running, you know, you can explain to someone like what they might go through, mm-hmm. but until you go through it, there's no way to really understand it. Yeah. So, it was a great course with a great support team, great race director, and it was put, you know, designed in a way that, you know, yeah, you're going to suffer, but you can go out there and focus on the task at hand. A lot of the logistical stuff is taken care of for you because it's a loop.
Okay.
So now that day, it was interesting. North Carolina, October, you know, you can't assume anything. and about for the 100-miler, I want to say 26 people started that race. Only 5 of us finished.
Wow.
And what had happened was they didn't anticipate the heat and humidity. So the sun burned through the clouds and it became like an 86, 87 degree day, and it was super humid. And a lot of people chafed, a lot of chafing, a lot of bleeding from places people don't want to bleed from.
Yeah.
And they just dropped like flies. So it just became like a war of attrition. But I loved it because, you know, you just beat yourself up, right? You're tearing yourself down to the core. Like when you're blistered, your feet are blistered, you're tired, you're dehydrated, and it's 5 o'clock in the morning, there's nothing but truth left. You know every step you're taking, there's the reason behind it. It's right there in your head, and there's no escaping that. Like,
yeah.
And I think that's the beauty of the ultra running sport, is that you get real honest with yourself and you start to understand a lot about yourself, because, you know, there's nothing to hide, you know, when you're that torn down. Literally people are popping blisters on your feet and, you know, you smell, and, you know, like you're nothing but humble at that point. And your whole goal is just one more step.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I think attracted me to the sport of ultra running, was putting everything aside for 24 hours or 30 hours and just focusing on moving and, you know, taking that next step. I think your life gets real simple at that point. And at the end of the day, I'm a kind of simple guy. So,
yeah. Well, I think that sign behind you, that poster, you're capable of more than you think, I think just sums it up. I think,
yeah.
So is that what it taught you, that first 100 coming out of that other day, once you recover?
What was my recovery? Oh, yeah, geez. So I did learn you're capable more than you think, probably with every step of the way, right? Every 5K, every 10K, every half marathon, like every time I would step up, you know, I would reiterate to myself, like, I know I can do more, right? And that's what I tell people too. Even at the end of a 100-miler, you got to walk to the car, right? So mm-hmm. I probably could have run more, right? So, I mean, that's what you learn. You learn that if you know you're not injured and you're willing to suffer, then you're gonna be successful, right? You have to be willing to put your mind aside and deal with pain, right? Injury is different. If you're injured, you got to stop. But if it's pain, I'm really good at calming that down and putting it to the side and continuing forward. And most things in life, just like a 100-mile race, if you can put your head down and do the work and grunt through it, you're going to be successful.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's what I learned from doing that first one, is that if I'm not injured and I just keep putting one foot in front of the other and don't let my mind give me the excuse to stop, I'm going to succeed. Nothing's going to stop me.
Yeah.
And recovery, man, you know, recovery, it's different every time. I think I'm getting better at running these things and I'm getting better at recovery, but I also think this sport will humble you in a minute. So as soon as you think you figured something out, something new is going to come at you. But that first race, the recovery was kind of brutal because I had really bad impact blisters on the bottom of my feet. Mm-hmm. And you do get to a point with these things where you basically say, I'll deal with it tomorrow, right? So you know you're doing damage and you say, I'll deal with it tomorrow. And that race, I probably couldn't walk for 2 days. Mm-hmm. You know, I bet you, like, if I counted my steps, it was like 200 steps, you know, whatever from the couch to the bathroom was, because the bottoms of my feet were so destroyed and blistered and, you know, like you just didn't want to get up.
Yeah.
You know, and then your appetite, I can't even explain to you what your body goes through at the end of a 100-miler. Like the next day I'd be full and then 2 minutes later be starving. And then my wife would bring me some food to eat and there'd be times where I'd look at it and I go, I don't even want that.
Yeah.
You know, and there'd be other times where, you know, I ate anything that you put in front of me. And I just think your body's metabolism is so jacked, you know, for a couple of days after a 100-miler that, that, you know, it's a crazy experience, you know? But the last 100-miler we just did in Umstead, the recovery, you know, the next day I was able to walk around pretty good. And probably a day or two later, I was out for my first run. So,
okay.
So the body is an amazing thing. You know, if you do the right stuff, it'll adapt.
Yeah. So how many hundreds have you done?
I've done 1, 2, 3, 4. I've done 4 now.
Okay.
Yeah. I've got my 5th one coming up in October.
What one's that?
Indiana Trail 100-miler.
Okay.
So yeah, it's a beautiful course. It's Chain of Lake Parks up at near Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Okay.
It's in October. So the weather there can be anywhere from warm, not hot, but warm, to freezing cold.
Okay.
It's a 25-mile loop through that park. So you do 4 loops. And it's about 9,000 feet of climbing, so it's not tremendous amount. So it's a good course to attack. And it's a Western States qualifier.
Yeah.
I got into Umstead this past year, which is also a Western States qualifier. So I've already got my lottery tickets for the year taken care of. So my plan in Indiana is to go for something I've never done before, which is to try to go sub 24 hours.
Okay. Okay.
So I'm going to attack it. And if anything goes wrong, it's not a big deal because I've already got my lottery tickets secured. So I'm in training right now, and my goal is to go up there and really give it a shot.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, so the Indiana, that's from carryover from last year, right?
Yeah, so I ran Indiana 2 years ago, and then it was canceled for COVID, and then I'm back this year. So Indiana is a great course. We call it hamster wheeling, but it's a qualifier for states, and basically, you know, you can get into it, and every year you can get in that race. So you get your lottery ticket. So there's a lot of runners up there that we kind of joke around because everybody's up there getting their lottery tickets for states. And, you know, the way it works is they double your tickets every year you stay qualified. So eventually you should get into Western States. But I've got friends that are well over 30 tickets now that still haven't gotten selected. So it's just the luck of the draw, man. You know, you go out there and do the best you can and hope the ultra gods, you know, shine on you one day.
Yeah, what would that mean to get into Western States?
From the standpoint of ultra running, it would mean everything. It's to me the it's the United States, you know, epitome of the sport. Like if you can successfully finish Western States, you're in a class in our sport that's, you know, by itself. It's a race in California. It's you've got a 30-hour cutoff. It has 23,000 feet or so of climbing. It's got about 18,000 feet of descent. And the temperatures, like this year, the temperatures were well over 100 degrees when they hit the valley.
Yeah.
So it is a brutal, brutal, beautiful course. And it is the epitome of the sport in the United States. There's on the world stage, there's Ultra Trail Mont Blanc, which is basically running around the Alps. you know, but that's not on the radar for me. I don't think I have the chops to quite make it to UTMB, but Western States, I think I can do it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So how'd you end up at Fleet Feet?
That's a great question. So, you know, going back to the whole, like, you know, if you're doing things and you make these changes in your life, you kind of migrate toward similar minds and things like that. When we came home from Europe, you know, I'm always grateful for the career I had at Sherwin-Williams. I'm always grateful for the career I had at the company before that, which was Unilever. You know, I loved my life as an executive, and I got to work with a lot of fascinating, amazing people. But I got to a point, you know, I was 46, 47 years old, and, you know, we had enough money. You know, I'm not the kind of guy who needs more than enough, you know, so we had enough. And life as an executive, you know, I was still traveling a lot over here in the U.S. when we came home, and it was a little bit stressful. You know, we were doing a lot of consolidating and things like that. And I just, you know, spoke to my wife one day and I said, look, you know, I think we have enough. And I think I'd be a lot happier just working at a running store, you know, and being around runners and people like that. And, you know, we slept on it and we kind of looked at the numbers again and made sure we thought we were good. And we called up the next day, my boss and Sherwin-Williams, and said, hey, we're going to retire early. Went and saw John Dewey, who, you know, mm-hmm. owner of Fleet Feet Greensboro High Point. And I said, hey, I'm this local ultra runner and I'm retiring early and I would love to come work at the store for, you know, you a couple days a week, whatever, you know, you'll have me. And he said, sure, you know, we'll bring you in. He goes, I don't know what kind of hours we'll be able to give you or anything like that. But, you know, and I said, initially, John, it doesn't matter, you know. So I started working at Fleet Feet 2017, I think it was. And I was probably doing 2-3 days a week, you know, that kind of thing. But then as time progressed, we actually got to a point where we were going to open our own Fleet Feet. So we started to work with Fleet Feet, identified markets, went down to Tampa Bay, and we were literally negotiating on a lease for a Fleet Feet in Tampa. And then the store manager for Greensboro left, and John came to me and just said, do you really want to leave Greensboro, you know, or would you prefer to stay? If you'd prefer to stay, you know, I think there's an opportunity here. We can create a job where you're the general manager of both stores. And, you know, he's like, I'd hate to lose you, but I understand if you need to go. Mm-hmm. But if you don't want to go, you know, there's this opportunity. So my wife and I talked about it and we were like, well, you know, I'd get to run a small company, which is what I want to do because John's, you know, really hands off now. And we wouldn't have to move from Greensboro. I love the trails here. I can run from my house and be on a trailhead in about 2 minutes. And we just decided, you know what? John's a great guy. You know, Fleet Feet, Greensboro High Point, great stores. Mm-hmm. Let's stay, you know. So we called up Fleet Feet the next day and said, hey, we're going to stop negotiating in Tampa and we're going to stay here with John. And they were fine. They were very supportive. They were like, hey, John's got a great guy there and you got a great situation. So we understand. And that was it. So I became the general manager and, you know, and that kind of brought us right up to the pandemic.
Yeah. That's, and that was, I'm sure that was a trying time, you know, over that year, I think for everybody in small businesses, I know struggled.
We struggled like everybody else. We definitely had, you know, I joke, you know, a near death experience there. But we were able to, we unfortunately had a shutter, you know, High Point for a while. Mm-hmm. And we pulled all the inventory into one store. I'd never seen anything like that. You know, I ran a $9 billion supply chain and what we experienced overnight with COVID, I'd never seen anything like that in my life, in my business life. We went, our demand dropped over 90% mm-hmm. overnight.
Yeah.
And, we kind of circled the wagons and myself, John, and the marketing manager, basically we'd go work there by ourselves every day in Greensboro and we would just shuttle shoes out the door. You know, our customers would call and we would just kind of, you know, curbside service, and it was enough to keep the lights on. Once we got to a point where we could reopen the doors in Greensboro and have people come in with masks and things like that, business was okay. Yeah. And we got stronger and, you know, the bills kind of got paid. And then the next thing we knew, we were looking at, hey, we could reopen High Point, you know, and started picking up some steam. And quite honestly, now we're, you know, we're doing great. We weathered the storm. The team has been nothing short of phenomenal. Our customers have been nothing short of phenomenal. They support us, and, we're stronger now than we've ever been before. So, you know, I hope COVID's almost over and that, you know, it gets in the rearview mirror. But as of today, I'd say we're a success story, and we owe that to the community, and we owe that to the employees. Our team's been incredibly flexible, incredibly diligent and working hard, and our customers have been incredibly supportive. The community's been supportive, and you know, it would be easy to sit here and say, oh, we, you know, we did it all ourselves, but we didn't do it all ourselves. You know, our team and our customers were the difference.
Yeah. And I think that was important. As being one of those customers, you know, I made sure that I bought shoes curbside, and I think we all tried to do what we could. And then, you know, even though we couldn't gather as a group, we were still training for things. You were still, you know, we had events that were canceled, but the hope is that we were still running, we were still biking, we still needed gear and things, and, you know, trying to get a heart rate monitor. You know how difficult that was for me to get a heart rate monitor. It took us months to get that thing.
Probably take months still today. There's a shortage of everything. It's crazy.
Yeah, so I think that's one of the things, again, about Greensboro. Everybody, you know, is so supportive, especially for, you know, what John's done for the community anyways and what Fleet Feet means for the community. It was easy to say, no, I could go somewhere else or order them from Amazon, but we're going to stay local and still try to help Fleet Feet keep the lights on, which is important.
Yeah. I think John has done a tremendous job with embedding Fleet Feet Greensboro into the community. And I think, you know, we've got a store manager and an assistant store manager in High Point now that I think are going to create that same, you know, process over in High Point. Like we get embedded in the community. Right. Mm-hmm. And the beautiful thing about it is, and you're probably one of the beneficiaries of this, right, is as we got healthier, we're able to give back more again to the community. Right. So beforehand, before the pandemic, we were doing those things, and we're back at it now. Like we're back to that point. So we've got, you know, we were sponsors, you know, the Crohn's run, you know, the Solstice run, you know, we've got the Unity run coming up in a couple of weeks in July downtown. You know, John is always trying to give back. We had, you know, Matt's Run for Hunger on the big run day. So John is always trying to give back to the community. And it's not, you know, we love the community, so we do it out of a place of our hearts, you know, but it's also our way of thanking people for supporting us, right? You know, if you're not giving back to the community, then what's the point, right? Yeah. So it's just a big thank you from us. Everything we try to do is all about thanking everybody for helping us continue down the road we've been on and making sure we're supporting our community, because we love Greensboro, we love High Point, you know, we love the Piedmont area.
Yeah, I think that's so important. You know, I've been in that store so many times, and the fact that John just lets me set up when we set up tables in there for our charity stuff. It's awesome. So Springboard, how'd you get the Hoka advertisement, that video you did? How did that happen?
So, obviously I was a huge fan of Hoka, ran in Hoka, and, working at the store, they had a campaign called Humans of Hoka, which was just like this thing where they take a picture of you and you kind of, you know, do a little profile, and then they market it. So I did that. And then, you know, I guess that Humans of Hoka campaign, they kind of thought, you know what, we're going to start to partner with Fleet Feet, and we're going to, you know, do commercials. So we're going to, you know, make some commercials for, you know, I think most of that stuff was on the internet. It was on, you know, Instagram and Facebook, things like that. But the sales rep that I worked with at the time, you know, knew that I was a huge ultra runner and that I was running exclusively basically in the Speed Goat from Hoka. So they called up one day and they just said, "You interested in shooting a commercial?" And I was like, "Well, I mean, of course, right? I have an ego like anybody else." Yeah. You know, I was like, "But is it going to highlight the store? Like I don't want to do it if it's not going to further, you know, what we're doing in the community and mm-hmm. Greensboro and High Point." And they were like, "Absolutely, it's going to highlight your store." So that was it. You know, they said, "We're going to come in," and it was cool. They sent a little crew here for a day. It was 2 days, I think. And they were awesome. They literally just, they'd ask you questions, you know, and you'd answer. And then we went out and did some running, and they would take a bunch of videos and still shots of you while you were running. And I thought they did a tremendous job of sharing my story in a minute. Mm-hmm. And I think they did a tremendous job of highlighting the store in a minute. And to me, I wouldn't have worked with those guys if I didn't think they had the same values. Like when you dig into Hoka and the company and the brand and the values that they have, they're there for someone who's on their feet all day at work, all the way through the elite, you know, runners that are out there doing road races or trail running, you know. And I think that's what I love about the brand is that it's a brand for everybody. You know, and we sell a lot of Hoka in the store because it's a great product with a great story. And it helps a lot of people, whether it's, you know, every day walking around in the hospital, a lot of nurses and doctors buy Hoka, or it's, you know, out on the trails. So, but, you know, that's, you know, you've been in our store a lot. And that's what's tremendous about most of these brands is, you know, not one shoe is going to work for everybody.
Yeah.
So you get to come in and you get to try all these great products. And that's what's really great about working at a place like Fleet Feet is not only do I use a lot of the products, I know they're good. And I know what we're capable of doing for people, whether it's someone in pain or someone who's trying to run a marathon or just someone who's trying to run faster. You know, I know that our team and our products can help them get there.
Yeah, that's the other thing I think why I love Fleet Feet so much. One, with John being a PT, and then everybody that's in there are typically they're runners. So you know that it's not like just going somewhere else where they're going to, "Here, try this shoe." I think they're, again, you're right. There's not one shoe that's going to fit and be perfect for everybody. But I think the fact of that kind of expertise that you guys give to others, to give to runners, and, you know, sometimes it's trial and error, but still – you know, you can bring it back and try something else. But I think you guys, there's definitely some science behind what you guys do, which is great.
Yeah, I think John being a PT, the training that we've gotten is better than, you know, probably the majority of running stores. Mm-hmm. You know, and then he's a resource, right? Yeah. So when there's a question, you know, I can literally pick up my iPhone and call John in 2 seconds, you know, have an answer that I wouldn't have had, you know, otherwise. Right. So, yeah, John, I think that's the thing about Greensboro, right? You can't separate John and Greensboro, Fleet Feet Greensboro. Right. So John, is a resource for the community. Right. And that's why people keep coming back, and because we're all the staff, we're all an extension of John. Right. Mm-hmm. So to me, you know, that's the incredible job he's done here, you know, over the last 14, 15 years is, you know, he's embedded himself in our store into the community in such a beneficial way. You know, and I think that's the part of the job I love most is like when you do help somebody, you know, you help them accomplish a goal, whether it's feeling better or running faster or hitting a PR, you're a part of that journey with them and they come back and they appreciate that.
Yeah. I think that's awesome. One last thing about Greensboro community before we move on, Doggettville. What does Doggettville mean to you?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's not just Doggettville. It's the Doggett family and the farm, right?
Yeah.
I think, you know, and you're well aware of this because of the events we do out there for you, the Solstice Run. I mean, I think it's a special place with a special family, you know? I mean, the Doggetts, you know, you go to them and you say, "Hey, we want to have Doggettville or we want to do the Solstice Run." And they say, "Sure," you know, and they open up their home to you, right? To the whole running community, right? So we're using their picnic benches where they literally have family picnics, and we're running on their land. We're running through their yards. We're running, you know. So what it means to me is, you know, all the things we just talked about for the last hour, you know, you can encapsulate it in a guy, you know, or a family like the Doggetts, right? Which is, you know, they're runners, they're farmers, they're part of the community, and literally they open up their entire home for these events and let us go hog wild out there.
Yeah.
You know, and the Enchanted Forest, it's, you know, 100, 150 yards of just awesomeness, right? Like, it's like going through Candyland as a kid or something. And, you know, when I was just out there a few weeks ago, right? And, you know, when we were running through that thing, that, you know, it was like 840, 845, and the fireflies were out there.
Yeah.
And it's truly an enchanted forest, you know? It's such a cool little place to run. But it's like, you know, it's home, it's family, it's the community. And I think, you know, you just get the vibe out there when you're with these guys, like, this is what we could do on any weekend, you know, just show up and go run around their farm with them, you know, and they'd be into it. So it's cool. And when we can do an event like your event, where we're raising money for a purpose, you know, I mean, what could you ask for? You've got friends, you know, you've got trails, you've got, you know, a good purpose, you know, a good, you know, charity that we're running for with Crohn's disease. I mean, what more could anybody want? I'm the happiest man in the world when I've got that going for me. I've got my friends around me and I'm running and, you know, we're raising money for a good cause. So I think the Doggetts are just awesome, sincere people that, you know, we're better off because they're in our life.
Oh, absolutely. I can't think of anybody else who let me come run at their, put on an event from 6:04 in the morning to 8:47 at night. And not even a blink of an eye, you know? So it is pretty cool. And, you know, kind of that event, the goal is to just get people come out all day long. We have a lot of people that just bring their families out, just do a mile, do 4 miles. That's the best of it. You know, you can have somebody like Darian running 74. You can have somebody coming out running 4 and still be part of the event, which is pretty cool. That's why I think if we can just kind of get people to prove that, one, you can do more than you're capable than you think, and people do push their numbers, and a lot of PRs out there, which is what makes me happy. At the end of the day, we've all combined our miles and done a lot, but people are always doing a little bit more than they think they could, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
So what are some goals? What do you, other than Western States? I know that's a goal. Out there that you want to
accomplish. Angeles Angels now too, right?
Yes.
So that's another goal, right? I mean, it's a great question. So, you know, my life for running, my life is really geared right now toward, you know, getting into Western States, right? Mm-hmm. But the things that the sport brings to me on a daily basis are just incredible. My brother-in-law running, you know, helping people at the store achieve things, going out for these races and meeting people who need to, you know, help getting through their last 10 miles so they run their first 100 miler. You know, those are things that I wouldn't say are goals, but are kind of ancillary things that happen to you on a regular basis when you put yourself out there that are just so enriching to your life, right? So, you know, when you say, like, what's your goals, you know, kind of besides Western States, I think it's to continue to be a part of that community in a way that I'm helping other people, right? You know, that would be one goal. I think another goal would be as I transition out of the sport. So, you know, you kind of get Western States done, whether that's a year from now or 5 years from now. I don't know if I'm going to keep doing 100 milers, right? There's a lot of commitment and it's a lot of commitment on your family and, you know, those types of things. But the sport's going to continue to be a big part of my life, right? So I think a goal for me is creating a plan where I transition from the sport but still have running, you know, be a major part of my life and continue to be healthy and running. Maybe it's not 100 milers, but all the way probably till the day that I die, right?
Yeah.
I would love to be that 70-year-old that's crossing the finish line at a marathon or something like that, you know? And I know it's possible. I know if I continue to do the things that I do, you know, that I'm going to get there, right? So to me, I think, you know, switching gears after Western States to a person who stays healthy and uses running to continue to enrich the community and enrich myself is kind of where I want to go next. You know, mm-hmm. I want to run till the day that I die, and I want to feel healthy till the day that I die. And I think running is a key component to that. But I understand also that it's going to be a very difficult transition, right? Mm-hmm. When all you do is run and train, and you switch gears, it's definitely going to be something that we have to think about. The other thing, you know, and you know, it might be the very last thing we talk about.
Yeah.
Is, you know, I do have a platform. So, So a lot of people, because of being general manager at Fleet Feet Greensboro and race directing, you know, the things I do with my blog, mm-hmm. The commercials for Hoka, a lot of people, you know, see me and hear what I say, right? And I do take that platform seriously, right? So, So you know, you see when I run out, you know, with you guys, I've got OWW Run Against Bullying, right?
Yeah.
So I'm very much the kind of person that I want to use the platform for a specific message. And to me, especially in the internet world that we're living in, it's become very easy for people to throw darts at each other and hurt each other without having to look each other in the eye. And I think we've seen a lot of negative things from that. You know, we've seen children turn to violence, children turn to drugs and alcohol, you know, and there's just a lot of, you know, caustic stuff going on out there. Yeah. You know, and, you know, I call it bullying. You can call it other things, but the bottom line is, you know, we're really hurting each other. And I think it's just facilitated by the fact we can do it behind a keyboard.
Yeah.
And I would like to see that change, right? So whenever I have the opportunity, you know, I've got my shirt on and I'm always talking about, I'm very much against bullying and I'm very much about inclusion and diversity and trying to make the world a better place, because there's just no reason for human beings to treat each other poorly. And, you know, and I think, you know, that's the one thing I use my platform to amplify, is that there's a better way to treat each other, you know, and particularly around kids, but everybody, honestly, even adults.
Yeah, I agree. So let's talk about the website and the blog. When did you start that, and how was it to start that? Was it difficult or was it an easy transition?
I mean, yeah, I started the blog, it was probably 2015 or late 2015, early 2016. And it was tough because, like, you know, to me, if you're going to do something like that, you should have something to say, right? So I thought, you know, what am I trying to say here, right? And really what I was trying to say is I'm not different, I'm not special. And I was able to do this, right? So you don't have to feel like you can't do this, right? You can't get healthy again. I think, you know, we've been fed, you know, through through marketing and capitalism and all the things. You know, there's a lot of positives to all that stuff, but there's also kind of this, you know, hey, you know what? It's $4. Go get 2 fried chicken sandwiches and. You know, life has become very convenient, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost like comfort's a lie in a way, right? You can die from just sitting around, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was kind of the reason behind the blog. It was to say, look, I'm no different. I'm not special. And I was way out of shape, like a lot of people are. And I got back into shape. And, you know, yeah, I drink a lot less Coca-Colas and a lot less beers, and I eat a lot less hamburgers and, you know, all those things, but I'm also healthy and living a really vibrant life. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I hope I'm going to be around for a while, right? And yeah. I'm going to enjoy this beautiful wife that I have, and I'm going to enjoy these beautiful kids that I have, and hopefully some grandkids someday, right? you know, and to me, you know, the real pandemic in our country started before COVID, and it was obesity and all the diseases associated with eating poorly and not exercising, heart disease, those types of things. And that pandemic's not going to go away. You know, COVID will go away in another 6 months or a year, hopefully. But our pandemic in this country, when it comes to obesity and heart disease and things like that, it's still raging out of control.
Yeah.
And I think it's a shame. You know, I don't think anything bad about these companies that do this stuff, but I do think we've got to start teaching our children moderation, you know, in school, and healthy balanced diets, and exercise needs to be important. You know, there's a lot of talk right now about things like fat shaming and stuff like that. Mm. And I don't think any of this stuff should ever be done with a negative intent. But I also think we have to be able to have conversations with each other about what's healthy and what's not healthy.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't think anyone should be not empowered by the way they look. But I also think we have to be honest about there's, you know, healthy weights and there's not healthy weights, and there's healthy diets and there's not healthy diets. And we have to start having those real conversations so that we can become a healthier country again.
Yeah.
And hopefully a healthier world. Right. Like, you know, that to me is the most important thing. It's not an aesthetic.
Yeah.
It's not the way people look. It's not, you know, is it necessary for someone to die at 68 because their heart failed, or could have that person lived differently and maybe lived to been a very healthy 88?
Yeah.
You know, and to me, that's what's important, right? Making sure people are living happy, healthy, fulfilled lives, not killing ourselves, you know, one French fry at a time.
Yeah, I think that's probably my whole mission with trying to do this podcast, which everybody, you know, as you know, with a blog, it's difficult. And I'm sure there's times that you're like just coming up with material and doing it. But I think there's such value in that. All it needs to be, if this podcast reaches one person who didn't think they can do it, but they hear, say, your story, or they hear somebody else's story in their 90s, and it really, there's value in that to say, look, yeah, you can do this. And I think you're right. We need so many more positive messages out there. And I think there's just too much negativity. We could spend hours on that, but I think if we can get people, one person to get to another person, it'll snowball. And then we can see everybody at the senior games running in their 80s and 90s, or just playing pickleball. Yeah. It doesn't have to be running. It just any activity is what we need to do. You know, we focus on anything, but it can be anything.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So I one blog I do want to talk about, get your ass to bed, into bed. So what do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. So get your ass into bed. Again, it's one of those things that there's a great deal of benefit to a good night's rest, that but there's always 50 reasons why you don't want to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is these devices that we all wear on our wrists.
Yep.
They're fascinating to me how accurate they are. You know, I write a lot about disruptors and things like that, right? If you drink alcohol, just a couple of beers, and then go to bed, your sleep won't be as well as if you didn't drink those beers.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows up on these devices. Like your heart rate, everything will change because you've had some alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Lack of sleep, it's the same thing. It's if you, you know, like I ran about 17, 18 miles today. If I don't go to bed tonight and get 7, 8, 9 hours of sleep, tomorrow is going to be a rough day, right? Your body recovers while it sleeps, that kind of thing. So get your ass to bed is basically me telling people that, look, your body needs time to recover. And there's no reason for you to be on your phone or your computer until 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. There's no reason to be out probably drinking alcohol or doing anything, you know, till 1 or 2 in the morning, because you're going to pay the price the next day at a minimum, maybe even more.
Mm-hmm.
So don't make excuses, you know, get a regiment going and get your ass to bed, you know, get your 8 hours of shut eye, you know, and your body will thank you for it.
Yeah. So since I'm kind of focused on the over 50, as you get into your late 50s and 60s and 70s, what is recovery? What do you see your recovery being like?
Yeah. I mean, so a lot of, you know, we didn't get into a lot of things, and we probably don't have the time to, but a lot of the things that we need to do are the things we probably don't like to do, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, cross training, you know, icing, you know, those types of things, right? So to me, you know, the recovery part of it is understanding that, you know, you need, you know, the right balance of complex carbohydrates, proteins, things like that, right? So, and that's dietary. Mm-hmm. There's supplements you can take that help as well. But obviously, the point is, you know, you want to try as often as possible. And of course, we got to do things in moderation, you know, mm-hmm. but as often as possible, you want to give your body the nutrition it needs, the fuel it needs to work out and to recover properly. And some of that's timing related too. You know, I had a protein, you know, shake, you know, 30 minutes, you know, after I ran today, because that's the window where you need to get those proteins mm-hmm. in your body to start recovering your muscles, things like that. But, you know, it can be, you know, as simple as just taking the time to understand you need to stretch, roll, ice, put your legs up, schedule recovery days, you know, into your training. Like, I know that sounds crazy. Some people don't think of it that way, but I literally, people I coach, I'll tell them, like, you know, Friday is a recovery day. So that means you can walk a mile or two, but no running. You know, you can go for a bike ride, you know, but you have to give your body time to recover. And I think that exponentially matters as you get older. You know, if you're 50 and you go and run 18 miles in the heat like I did today, I probably, you know, would recover a lot better from that when I was 18, mm-hmm. you know, than when I'm 50. Right. So I think, you know, it just taking the consideration and having the discipline to do those things becomes more and more important as you get older to make sure you're maintaining your body in a healthy way so that you don't get injured. Because, you know, that's the thing I think that starts people down the wrong path is you start having injuries and kind of like they continue to go. Eventually that's when you kind of give up, right? You say, all right, I've been injured and then I started and I got injured again. And, you know, and next thing you know, you're kind of sitting on the couch, right? So I think recovery as you get older is almost as important as working out. You know, you got to be methodical about it.
Yeah. Do you strength train at all?
Yeah, I do. I hate it, but I do. you know, and it's a time thing for me. Like if it's, you know, time to do cross training or time to run, I'd rather go run, yeah. You know. But yeah, you have to do different things to make sure the engine is in good condition. And I would imagine it's like that, you know, with any sport, like there's probably, you know, football players who hate running, but they run, right? So there's runners probably hate hitting the weight room, but, yeah. But you know, it's necessary.
Yeah. I became a better runner when I started doing triathlons because it forced me to swim and bike. And like today I did my half hour in the pool. It sucked. I hated it, but I did it and I feel better for doing it. But it definitely, again, that 30 minutes of just cardio in there and not abusing my body is the best thing, and just kicking. And so it definitely is important. And I think as we age, I'm a lot less broken down now when I was before, when I would run all the time.
Yeah.
So
that makes sense.
Yeah. So I don't want to keep you much longer, but I know the one quote behind you. Do you have any other quotes or mantras that you use to kind of get through the tough times?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So obviously that's a pretty uplifting. You are, you know, you're capable of more than you can think, you know, you think, that kind of thing. But you know, when I saw like you were going to talk about mantras and things like that, you know, I'm a big fan of self-talk, like self-positivity. So like you'll notice a lot of the times I run, I have a hat on that says machine or beast, yep. You know, that kind of thing. And that's because those are the things I hang my hat on, no pun intended, when things are going, you know, poorly out there, right? Is like, you know, you're a machine. You can go one more step. You know, keep moving, that kind of thing. So, I mean, you know, I think it's important for people to have those things in their mind. A lot of the times when I'm running, you know, I'll say to myself, you know, you're running light. And I'll kind of repeat that in my head. because, you know, it's a message for me inside to not, you know, feel heavy, right? Like you're running light. You know, I tell myself I'm the storm. I don't know if you know the saying behind all that, but, you know, the devil whispers in your ear that you'll never make it through the storm, and you whisper back to the devil, I am the storm, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, those are the types of things that go through my head when I'm running and I need to keep moving is, you know, be tough, you know. So I don't know if I have catchphrases other than the one behind me and things that that I kind of rattle off over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to do the things that I do, you know, you have to be mentally tough. And I think where I draw my inspiration from are people that I know that can't put down their ailments. So my brother-in-law, you know, if I run 100 miles and I'm in pain, it's going to stop. I'm going to get to the finish line and I'm going to be able to put it away. He can't put it away. Every day he wakes up with that bar in his head and he has to continue to figure out how to get through each day. Yeah. I've got family members that have type 1 diabetes, Crohn's disease, right? So I draw a lot of inspiration from the people I know that can't put down their problems. Mm-hmm. And you know, I even made a post for Indiana Trail 2 years ago where I literally told all these people I knew and I cared about, like, let me carry your problems for 100 miles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're a cancer, you're for the next 100 miles, that's all on my back. Let me carry that.
Yeah.
And I think those are the things that that I use to keep myself moving when I'm not injured but want to quit is I don't quit because I know there's people who can't quit.
Yeah, and I think that's important. I think if you've seen any things that I do, you know, I had a friend of mine go through cancer. She passed away. It's been 5 years now. And I started triathlon as she was going through her cancer journey. So again, as I was suffering, we talked, and I think that's the other thing. It's one thing for us, you know, people may think we're selfish by using other people's suffering to kind of get through what we're doing. But I think if we can, you have to talk to them about it. You just can't do it yourself. You have to say, look, I did this mile for you. I did this event for you. And I did, like, just you summed it up perfectly, is I want to take your pain away from you. I know it may seem simple, but I'm not a guy that can sit and just pray. I need to go out, and the way I pray and have that time is to actually do something, and I'm actually doing something for them and thinking about them the whole time I'm doing it. And, you know, yep, dedicating a mile, you're doing whatever it is. And I think there's such value as long as we go back and we actually talk to them about that and say, look, this is why I'm doing it. And I really want it's to pick them up and say, look, I can't take your cancer away from you, but I can at least be there and actually take every step of that journey with you. And I'm here. You need something? Yeah. I'm here for you.
So I agree. 100%.
So that leads me to my last hashtag that I use all the time is my miles are for. What are the miles that you do in life and on the trails and anywhere else? What's the word?
Yeah, OWW, run against bullying. Yeah. So it's, you know, to me, like I said, you know, there's 50 things that would be great causes, but I don't want to muddy the water. So the one thing I always try to put out there on the platform is stop bullying each other and start caring about each other. And like I said, I focus on children. I think it's important for adults as well, but, it breaks my heart when I see a child being torn up by someone for no valid reason. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say is every mile that I'm out there, I'm hoping that it's sending the message that, you know, let's stop bullying.
Awesome. How can people find you, Joe?
So the best way is the blog, joerandini.com. So it's joerandini.com. I do have social media, but quite honestly, during the pandemic, I more or less stopped posting. And the reason wasn't what I was posting. I just got tired of every time I would go on, there was just so much negativity and it started to mess with my mental state. Just friends, family, just, you know, I just think social media is it's a tool like any other tool, and you can use it for a lot of positive. But we seem to use it to just throw darts at each other, mm-hmm. And there's no context, and there's no valid conversation. It's just mean memes and things like that. So, so I am, you know, on Instagram, Joe the Runner. But I'm not sure when I'll go back on these platforms. On Facebook, it's Joe Randini. But honestly, the best way is the blog, and the reason I like the blog is I literally can look at everybody's reply, and if I see someone trying to put something up on a post that's not going to be helpful, I just don't let it through. Yeah. So I have a little bit of control over the vibe on the blog, and I like it that way because, you know, all I want is anything that I'm doing to be used in a positive way. I don't want anything I'm doing to ever be used in a negative way. It's just not who I am. And I've never seen anything come, you know, go badly out of love and caring. And I've never seen anything good come out of hate and negativity. So,
Yeah.
And then obviously I work at Fleet Feet Greensboro Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So you're always welcome to swing by if you're in Greensboro to see me or to talk running or anything else.
Awesome, Joe. Thank you so much for taking time. I'm so glad I asked you to appear kind of on the podcast and just to hang out with me. It's so good to get to know you a little bit more.
No, it was absolutely my pleasure, and I'm sure you and I will run a couple more miles together in the near future.
Absolutely.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode and were able to gain some insight into how one weathering athlete approaches each day of training and racing to stay as injury-free as possible. I believe his biggest strength is his willingness to look at the positive and to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. His sense of purpose is incredible and can be a lesson to anyone in both life and athletics. In the past 10 years, through sacrifice and persistence, he has worked himself from 330 pounds and barely able to run around the block, and as he states, that guy that liked to go out and entertain, to a multiple 100-mile ultra event finisher and getting his ass into bed at a decent time. He has set a goal of competing in Western States. His sense of humor and willingness to accentuate the positive is evident in his blog, which I highly recommend you check out. We are in 100% agreement that the world would be a better place if it could harness the positivity of race day and were led by runners and triathletes. I can promise you two things. If you live in Greensboro and you need anything running related, Joe and Fleet Feet Greensboro High Point, it will go to the ends of the earth to locate it like they did for my heart rate monitor during the year of COVID. And secondly, no matter where you are, if Joe is in your race and you need someone to pick you up and help you accomplish your goal of finishing, Joe will be that guy, even if that means sacrificing a PR, because as he states, the feeling of finishing a race and having the satisfaction of helping someone else in the process lasts longer. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. If you find today's or any other episode inspiring, I ask you to consider in joining our patron program. Details can be found at www.weatheredathlete.com. Also, please don't forget to hit subscribe to this podcast, share with your friends, give me a rating on iTunes, leave me a comment or drop me a line if you feel you have what it takes to enter the Weathered Athlete podcast. Lastly, no matter how you complete your miles, I encourage you to use the following hashtag, #MyMilesAre4, as a way to reinforce the purpose of those miles. As always, my miles are for the journey. Pete Borusik.